Welcome to the Womanist Voice podcast. I am Dr. Sarah Hussain, and today I am joined by Dr. Leonie Jackson to discuss the recent riots. I want to better understand why there is a rise of Islamophobia in the UK, and I believe Dr. Leonie's book, Islamophobia in Britain, gives us a better understanding of how we got to a place of such contention. Dr. Leonie is a senior lecturer in international relations at Northumbria University, whose research focuses on gender and racialized representations in terrorism and counterterrorism. She is an editor for the journal Critical Studies on Terrorism and the author of Islamophobia in Britain, The Monstrous and the Vulnerable, and What is Counterterrorism For? Welcome, Dr. Leonie, and thank you for joining us today at KLTV.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
I want to begin by commending your book, Islamophobia in Britain. It's clear the amount of research that went into producing it, with the recent uprise of tension in the last few months, I really believe it is essential reading for all. It's objective and takes into consideration various factors that have contributed to the problems we face today in relation to race relations. I read about your initial experience while studying politics at university. Can you tell our listeners about this experience and why you were inspired to write the book Islamophobia in Britain?
Sure. So I started university in September 2001. And obviously the September 11th attacks happened very shortly after. And we didn't really find out what had happened and why until a couple of weeks after that. And I really clearly remember being in a lecture theatre waiting for the instructor to arrive, and a friend of mine who was a Muslim woman, a visibly Muslim woman with a headscarf, was being questioned relentlessly about why the terrorist attacks had happened. Yes. Desperately trying to answer the questions as best she could, being very, taking the questions very seriously and trying to answer them. And was being bombarded basically with these questions, yeah, which immediately seems wrong. Muslims shouldn't have to explain this, right? But what really struck me was that a white woman took me aside and sort of said to me, how can she say that this has nothing to do with Islam? You know, how can she say this? It's clearly, it's all about Islam. And it struck me at the time, but more as I was researching this book and writing this book, that as a visibly white, non-Muslim woman, that I was being kind of brought into these conversations where the person who was discussing this with me assumed that I would agree with them in some way. Yeah. And that as a white, non-Muslim woman, that happened frequently, actually, that is part of the conversation. And it's as a non-Muslim woman writing this book, you know, some people ask me, well, what right do you have to write this? Which is a very genuine question, and it's fair enough to ask that. But I think that Islamophobia actually affects everyone. It is not just Muslims who are affected, yeah, by it. It affects the world and the country and the localities in which we live, and that we all have a duty to respond to it and to argue against.
I thank you for sharing that, and I completely agree with you. I feel as though there is a lack of understanding of the meaning of Islamophobia, and I think that kind of plays into why there's such kind of contention in the country today. I believe a better understanding of what it means would encourage more empathy and social cohesion within communities. Because of your research, I feel like you could give us a better understanding of what Islamophobia means.
Mm-hmm. I think that the simplest way to look at it, there are different understandings of it, but the simplest way for me to understand it is the idea that Muslims are somehow different, right? Somehow different, mm-hmm, to white British people, to other kind of ethnic minorities or other religious groups, that they are somehow can't be integrated or won't be integrated, and that is dangerous in some way. Yeah. And we see this in discussions about kind of social integration, community cohesion, our localities. In the recent riots, we saw a lot of this, right? And we see in discussions about terrorism, which is another area in which Muslims come up a lot as somehow different and foreign and not like us.
Yeah.
And I think that every kind of expression of Islamophobia that you hear, you can almost bring it back to that idea of difference.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. When I was reading your book, I read about the representations of the good and the bad Muslim in your book. So you wrote, by emphasizing culture as the single most important feature of the 2001 uprisings, community cohesion discourse played a fundamental role in the racialization of British Muslims. Can you expand on this? And do you think there is a correlation between this and the discourse surrounding the recent riots?
Yeah. I think it's so interesting to go back to the 2001 uprisings. So if we just, they happened in this area, you know, the north of England, in the former mill towns. But the Bradford one was officially called a riot. So I think it's helpful to kind of look at that one. Bradford is seen as this archetypal kind of segregated community where it has a large population of Muslims.
Yeah.
But the whole of Bradford is very socially segregated because of kind of racialized housing policies from the 70s and the 80s. What we saw after the 2001 riots in Bradford was this attempt by the government to blame culture for it. So it wasn't seen as the kind of socioeconomic deprivation that goes on in Bradford. You know, it's a very economically deprived city. It wasn't to do with those segregated housing policies, which have created what the government called parallel lives at the time. But it was seen as something to do with Muslim culture. That means that they, Muslims, are different, are dangerous, are foreign, and they self-segregate. That's what the argument was. And I think if we look at the kind of discussions about the recent riots, we don't see that when people are talking about the people who rioted on the street. We don't see people saying, well, these white working class men are segregating themselves from the rest of the community. We don't see a cultural explanation.
Yeah.
We see that their grievances are taken seriously, even if it's seen as you shouldn't be rioting. But the reason that you're rioting, you know, there's a good reason for that.
Yeah.
And I don't think we saw, well, we didn't see that in 2001 at all.
I mean, I'd like to come back to that because I have strong feelings about this idea of assimilation. But whilst watching the media coverage on the recent riots, I couldn't help feel a sense of bias. And you mentioned how an initial separation was made between white and Asian youth that participated in the uprisings. Do you feel that same separation in the representations of young people who participated in the recent riot? So the reason I ask you that is because, you know, I might have some unconscious bias, and I did feel that separation. But from your perspective, did you also see the separation in the representation?
Yeah, there's the tendency to take seriously the people who rioted, right? The white kind of people who were going. That it's not helpful to call them all far right.
Absolutely.
Right? But the people who were at those kind of rallies and who were there. There's definitely a separation because their grievances are taken seriously.
Yeah.
Because there's a sense that they're doing it in the wrong way, but they have grievances that we have to listen to.
Mm.
We do not get that with. We didn't get it in 2001, and we do not get it with the Muslims or South Asians who are defending their communities. It's seen. There is a sense that kind of violence emerges from those communities.
Yes.
And rather than them reacting as the white rioters are seen as doing.
I was thinking about this idea of social activism. So in the mind of this person who's coming now, it could be that they were writing because of anti-immigration policy, you know. And I was kind of thinking about this idea of social activism and how it's an essential part of promoting change. But I feel when we label defence in a radical context, we take away the voice of the oppressed. How acceptable do you think it is to defend yourself?
I can totally understand why people who feel that they are being targeted in their communities feel like they have to stand for their communities and defend them, right? And it was very clear that Muslim communities were being attacked, mosques were being attacked, people who looked visibly different were being subjected to violence. Yeah. And so what do you do in that situation? Do you just stay at home and let the streets be torched, or, you know, the glass be broken or whatever it might be? This, obviously, the police would probably say, no, don't make things worse. Yeah. And you often see that in when these, periodically, it seems now, these waves of kind of far-right protest, riots, uprisings, whatever they might be, that the police ask people not to kind of provoke, to make it worse, not to be there. But whose country is this? Whose streets are these? You know, if we recognise, as we should, everyone here as having a stake in this society, then protecting that society is part of that.
Yeah. I feel like, for me, when the riots were going on, and I felt very vulnerable. Mm. And what I realised at that moment was the voice of my white friend, my white peer, I needed an ally. And you don't understand how much that voice meant to me in that moment, because I felt like my voice wasn't powerful. So when I was reading your book, I really felt the point you made about discourse surrounding Muslim women and how they were portrayed as victims in need of state intervention. This one really touched me, because my PhD research was all about challenging predominant victimhood trope associated with South Asian women, and actually exposes how the Victorian feminist literature contributed to pushing the imperial saviour narrative. And for me, when I read about the dichotomy of good oppressed women and the bad patriarchal men, it really spoke to me, as I often feel the voice of the woman of the East is only really amplified if you agree that Islam and the culture of the East is barbaric. But if you are a woman of colour who recognises Western ethnocentrism and speaks positively about your religion and culture, your voice is silenced. So what are your thoughts on the dichotomy of good oppressed women?
It's a very old trope. And as you know, you mentioned imperialism. It comes fully from that, from Orientalism. It's a very old trope. And we see it consistently regurgitated. So we saw it in 2001 when Muslim women were basically blamed for the men, their sons, that came out on the street.
Yeah.
It was this idea that Muslim women can't control their children because of patriarchy.
Right? Yeah.
We see it very often in counter-terrorism discourse. If you remember when the so-called jihadi brides went, it was supposedly Muslim women who couldn't control their daughters.
Yeah.
And it's this idea that Muslim women are only savable, as you say, if they are victims.
Yeah.
So the very outspoken Muslim women, of which there are many, who positively discuss their faith and how their values that emerge from that are quite often seen as part of the trope of the sort of angry woman trope, you know. So we see there is very much a focus on the idea that patriarchy emerges from Muslim communities. Like, it's in British society, no, we've finished with patriarchy. We are very kind of gender equal nowadays, but in Muslim communities that's where it's seen to emerge, which is obviously wrong and problematic, because if we don't focus on where sexism, where oppression exists within our full society, then we miss it. And obviously it is not just a problem of the Muslim community, that's absurd, but it creates these identities where Muslim women who are seen as quiet, you know, good, not causing any problems, are seen as perfect victims, ideal victims, we can help them. And Muslim women who are much more forthright are seen as problematic for society.
Yeah. I feel like if you, like I said, if you are more informed about imperialism and you have knowledge of the British Empire, you know, your voice is silenced. But if you're someone who says, yes, I agree, you know, that Muslim women shouldn't be wearing, you know, they're oppressed and the veil should be banned, then I feel like you're seen as an ally. Mm-hmm. And I think that's unfair, because what that tells me is that I have to assimilate in order to be accepted. And I think that notion, since I was young, always bothered me, because I don't believe that you have to. You and I can both have different ideas and still be friends. Mm-hmm. I think when I consider this idea of assimilation, I think about when Britain invaded India, for example. And I always wonder, how far did the British embrace South Asian culture, the Hindustani culture of that time? And actually, if you look at every one of those colonies where there was a British presence, there was the Christian civilizing mission. So there was an idea of going there and actually changing the culture there. So it's quite ironic now that people get upset about England becoming, you know, less white, because we are only here because Britain was there first. And I think for some reason, this seems to be kind of ignored in this whole conversation about immigration. And for me, I feel if the immigration conversation, I think there's nothing wrong with feeling a sense of concern towards immigration. You know, it's a real, but I believe there are ways to go about this concern, to voice your concerns. And I think the way the riots happened, for me, it just felt like an excuse for people who have underlying racial hatred to come out on the streets and really voice their uninformed opinions. And I know not every, you can't, for just the way I don't like every single Muslim woman being associated with the voiceless oppressed. And I know not every single white person is a far-right racist, but I do feel like those voices the past 2 months have been quite loud. Mm-hmm. And when you're a minority, you kind of can feel quite, it can make you feel quite afraid and vulnerable, I think. So I do think that these conversations are really important, because I think we need a better understanding of why the rise in Islamophobia is happening. You go on to write about how bad Muslims were targeted through initiatives which admonished them from speaking native languages at home. Again, another point that really struck me. Do you feel this had a negative effect on the Muslim community?
Yeah, because again, that was related to gender, to women, right? It was this idea that Muslim mothers are speaking Urdu or Bengali at home, and as a result, their children are not learning English well. They can't help them with their homework. And then this means that the children won't do well at school, and it creates generational poverty, basically. But it's this focus, again, on the idea that English is the answer, right? The English language is the answer. Yeah. We had this as well in counterterrorism discourse when they were talking about Muslim mothers who weren't speaking English at home, didn't know what their children were doing on the internet or whatever, and hence they were being radicalized or whatever it might be. So it's this focus on Muslim mothers, right? And you know, this has a long history, the idea that mothers are the problem, yeah, whether it be Muslim mothers or non-Muslim, yeah, mothers. But of course, it impacts on the Muslim community, because it's a way of a forcible assimilation. What happens in the home of someone shouldn't be really anything to do with the state, but because it was focused on Muslims, it was accepted. So the government, at this time, you know, in the 2000s, when there was a lot of paranoia, basically, that Muslims weren't integrating, that they were involved in violence, the government reserves the right to interfere in the homes and the private lives of Muslim communities. And because it's Muslim communities and there's so much paranoia, there is very little kind of backlash, basically, from most of society. So yeah, it absolutely has impacted. How could it not impact, yeah, Muslim communities? Because it's a way of holding them up and saying, this community is different, this community is dangerous.
Yeah.
And so therefore the state needs to intervene within that community's lives.
And you think about the English language, for me, I feel like globally, English language is associated with intelligence. And I think that's absurd. You don't have to, you can be a scientist in China and you don't have to speak English to be intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder where this, I always wonder where this idea came from. And it goes, for me, it always goes back to imperialism again. I wonder how much Hindu, for example, or Tamil, the English trader learnt when he was ravaging the forests of the Himalayas. Like, mm-hmm. And I think for me, when you have a first generation young woman who came to the UK, and that's the one thing that she's has that's her own.
Okay.
It could be an Urdu or Punjabi language. And I think, why should she have to give that up? You know, I don't feel that again, there's a need for her to have to give her language up. But this, you know, of course, I understand this idea of speaking English to be able to integrate and it makes your life easier. And, you know, there's so many advantages. But again, I always hear that argument of you come into our country then. So if you come into our country, you know, learn the language. And I believe that argument would have some strength if Britain was never in any of those other countries for decades.
Mm.
If Britain wasn't in India for so many decades, then that's absolutely right. But for me, it seems hypocritical for you to go into a country, loot the country, and then complain about having to share with the same people that you took you were taking from. So I think for me, I honestly believe that, you know, there's a lack of knowledge in the area of the British Empire, which is why I wrote my novel, because I felt there was a gap.
Mm.
And I think there's a gap at institution level, there's a gap in schools, and I think there's a sense of arrogance because people don't know the history of the empire well enough. And also, for me, it's the media. So that's my last question, really. Do you think the press are the main culprits in causing division? Should the press take more accountability?
I think they're a big culprit. But especially if we look at these riots, social media is hugely responsible for this, right? So we had disinformation from the attacks in Southport.
Yeah.
We had from an online news paper that is known for its misinformation, and that someone has been arrested in the last couple of days in Pakistan for. So a kind of global issue. We had Tommy Robinson on Twitter, X, former English Defence League leader. We had Nigel Farage on TikTok.
Yeah.
We had Telegram channels in which the far right were organising.
Yeah.
So this is all outside of what we would usually think of as the media, right? Mainstream media, the press. So the mainstream media has a lot to answer for, right?
Yeah.
It has, especially kind of tabloid newspapers, have consistently pushed an anti-immigration sentiment for years.
Yeah.
And so those tropes and those ideas and those stereotypes are really firmly in people's minds.
Yeah.
But where the difference between now and the 2001 riots is there was no social media in 2001, right?
Yeah.
And so it can very quickly change as an incident into tinderbox conditions, basically. Yeah. And this is what's happened here. So, yes, the media is definitely partially responsible and should take accountability. Mm. And you've seen actually some newspapers, more broadsheet newspapers, but thinking about the language that they use in these when incidents happen, thinking about the term, for example, illegal immigrant. Some newspapers such as The Guardian are now using undocumented migrant, which changes the way we think about that.
So there's a lot of YouTubers who have a lot of followers and their views are very sensationalist. And I think, like you said, social media has become that powerful that it can be dangerous for someone who is so influential, but the uninformed. Yeah. And everybody jumps on the bandwagon, which is why I really wanted to call you, because you're someone who's done a lot of research. And I think it's so essential that that objective, informed voice is out there. And I feel like it's not. You have commercialized, you know, works out there. And I feel like your book should be, everybody should be reading your book. And I think on a last note, I want to end on a positive note. And I think for me, I've been thinking about how can we move forward. Last month, everybody was quite emotional and a lot of feelings were coming out, but things have calmed down a little bit. And essentially, we're all human. We share the same earth, and whether we like it or not, we have to get along. And for me, I feel the way to move forward is through education, and it's through learning, it's through conversation. How do you think that we can move forward? Because it feels like from 2001 to now, it only got worse. So what can we do?
Yeah, I would agree with you. When I was watching what was happening with the riots, about halfway through, there was a kind of a turning point, sort of, which was a lot of people were coming out to counter-protest. So in Newcastle, where I live, there was a planned far-right demonstration on one of the streets where all the kind of South Asian supermarkets, the mosques are. And 3,000 people turned out to counter-protest that. And it just swamped the far-right. And it was people who were there, you know, it wasn't just Muslims, it wasn't just South Asian people, it was the whole community.
Yeah.
And it was so powerful to see that. When you're talking about that allyship that you mentioned earlier, it's so important to feel that people have got you back.
Yeah.
And that is, for me, that's the key, right? We have to look out for one another. Yeah. We have to be strong and we have to stand for one another. And seeing that happening across the country and being able to speak with my own friends who, you know, feeling like you're vulnerable because they're visibly Muslim.
Yeah.
And just having that conversation and just saying, you know, I know I don't understand. I'm not a visibly Muslim woman. I know, but I'm here for you.
Yeah.
And that is key for me.
Yeah. And that thank you, because like, to hear you say that makes me feel so, it makes me feel loved. I think that's what it is. I've been feeling a sense of, it's not nice to feel hated. And I think for me, if I could give anybody, a person who has at the moment feels a little bit of hate towards Muslims, I just want to say to you out there that I'm your friend. If you meet me, you know, I would be the first person to make you a cup of tea, to invite you to my home, that, you know, I know that there are, you get people who are radical in all walks of life, but that's not everyone. And, you know, you've got to sometimes look at the person you're working with. How nice is the person you're working with? Don't use one negative experience of someone to make you form a representation of every other single person in one set of community. There's so many people on the earth, and we have more in common. So thank you for coming today to be a part of this conversation. And I hope that anybody who listens to this conversation can become more informed, and I hope that we can win the hearts of people.
Thank you so much for having me.